Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scher is on sabbatical until October. It's been more than a week since the I-5 bridge over the Skagit River at Mount Vernon collapsed. Workers are already assembling the temporary span that should be drivable by next month, and Washington State transportation officials hope that the permanent replacement bridge will be in place by September. That bridge collapse prompted a review of state bridges, along with calls for money to upgrade, replace, or repair those bridges and road problems that have been flagged with potential problems. It's something legislators, we think, are pondering as their 30-day extra session heads into its fourth week on Monday, that Monday ahead of us. And joining us to talk about bridges and how you pay for replacing them and more, our panel of journalists, Joni Balter, Seattle Times political writer and editor, back from a trip abroad where bridges made headlines.
They did. They were talking it up there. I saw it on the crawl there while I was on the treadmill.
In some other language.
It was like Croatian or something.
Knut Berger's the Mossback at crosscut.com. And joining us is Josh Feit, founder and editor of Publicola at Seattle Met and a legislative watcher, Josh. So thanks for coming in. And we want to start with you. Do you think that I-5 bridge collapse is going to move the mood of the anti-tax contingent down in
Libya? The Republicans have said no, and they've accused the Democrats of exploiting the bridge collapse. And I think that's really off base. They're not exploiting this. It's not as if the Democrats have suddenly seized upon a disaster and said, "Oh my gosh, we have to fund this, and this is an excuse for new taxes." The Democrats have been calling for this $8.4 billion package at this point. It used to be $8.8, scaled down a little bit, all session. And in fact, what it is, it's not exploitation. It's proof. And, you know, proof that something needs to be done. Tim Iman, who is another part of the conservative faction that has said this is exploitation, you know, he's often said over the years as he's been running his tax slashing initiatives, you know, the Democrats always say the sky is going to fall. Look, it didn't fall. Well, guess what? Bridges are falling. So it's not exploitation. It's proof. And frankly, the Republicans, who also accuse the Democrats of having the wrong priorities, right? So they kind of say, hey, this is all for hippie stuff. It's not for maintenance. It's for stormwater runoff and also for new big projects. A couple of reactions. One, when did the Republican Party stop believing in building things? Okay, that's the first thing that's sort of weird. This is not your, you know, the Republicans used to believe in building things. So I guess that's changed. And second of all, they're absolutely wrong about this priorities. While I would actually agree with the criticism that there's not enough maintenance in there, there's almost $1 billion worth of maintenance, which is $1 billion more than the Republicans have proposed. And additionally, this stormwater runoff, there's about $26 million. And additionally, there's some provisions in the legislation that says they have to sort of pay attention to those issues, which I think is a good thing. Prevents costs down the line. It's efficient.
Well, one of the fun things, just landing here and reading some of this, as particularly Danny Westneat's column from the Seattle Times, I just thought it triggered the most interesting conversation about whether or not a bridge should be able to withstand a truck hitting it. So there was a quote from a representative from Wenatchee, Carrie Condotta, saying, "You could strike a brand new bridge with a semi-truck and it will come down." Really? So what about when we build other things to withstand earthquakes? So this conversation is fascinating. If you think about it, I thought that we built bridges so that they wouldn't come down. Silly me, but
yeah, Knut, you had a great column this week on Crosscut. It was more about stopping construction as opposed to fixing things. You were talking about the Thompson Highway to Nowhere. Those overpasses that are sort of down by the old Museum of History and Industry are going to come down. But I was interested to see that like a college student could help lead a movement to stop things from going up, but we can't fix bridges.
Well, yeah, in some ways it's easier to stop something than it is to make something happen. Olympia is living proof of that. Whether you're talking about guns or gun control or bridges, crises don't seem to move politics very much or very far because of other interests that are in play. I thought Josh said something to me that is one of the interesting points of this whole thing is the way in which the idea of repairing infrastructure, is some kind of liberal conspiracy when it's the business community that's affected the most. When you interrupt traffic on I-5 and in a key place like that, and when you start looking out at the, whether it's freight mobility or whatever, keeping the current system, if you do nothing else, keeping the current system viable is the conservative option in all meanings of that. So there's a lot to dislike in a lot of the different transportation plans. There's legitimate arguments about, how the Columbia River crossings should be configured. There are all kinds of legitimate transportation debates, but I think the response to the bridge thing is not so much about going out and fixing specific bridges, although it would be nice if they could do that. To me, it's really about the kind of long-term orientation of transportation policy, and that we're in a situation where the existing stuff is problematic. And I think as Inslee and other people have said, the focus ought to be on fixing and maintaining what is, certainly before you get completely wrapped up on building new projects, particularly freeway projects, that are of dubious value.
Josh?
I was just going to say another irony here from the Republicans in terms of the transportation, or maybe hypocrisy, stronger word, on the transportation package that's being proposed is the issue of local control. I mean, one thing the Republicans have come out against in this sort of anti-tax pathology, even if it doesn't affect them in terms of taxation policy, they just don't want to be on record for taxes. And part of the package is about local districts being able to tax themselves so that they can fund transit, buses. And that has hung up this package.
Are you talking specifically about the request from King County to...
That's one of the main requests in there. Yes.
And is that part of this transportation package itself?
That's part of the package, absolutely.
Oh, so is there any move, do you think, in Olympia to sort of tease out some of these things? Well, maybe
I think the compromise that they're looking at is maybe a referendum clause so that it would require King County to send it for a vote, and I think to the public, and the Republicans are more amenable to that.
What about the $8.4 billion transportation package? Is there any attempt for people to say, well, hey, maybe we don't want to think about new highways, or maybe we want to deal with the Columbia River crossing some other way, but look, we've got this now list of critically, what was it, structurally critical bridges that because we see so much oversized traffic, particularly because these were built in a time where things were smaller, that maybe we should address the potential of collapse.
Yeah, I mean, again, there's almost a billion more than the Republicans have proposed in maintenance. I agree, and Knut's right. I mean, part of the criticism here that it's these big ticket item projects, quite frankly, which ultimately end up getting Republican votes because they're in their districts and they want these projects and they want to do the ribbon cuttings, and that's partially why they're there. So I don't know if it's going to shift the conversation or not. The CRC conversation obviously is at a standstill. Inslee vetoed the sort of compromise the Republicans...
CRC is Columbia River Crossing.
Yeah, because it didn't have the $450 million that Washington State needs to put up to move this project forward, get the review, and get federal matching money. So,
well, it seems like a lot of the bridge repair on this particular will be paid by the federal government. But it does make a lot of sense that if you have a list of bridges that are critical, that you would then, if you're going to do a transportation project, somebody is going to push for, let's hit some of the ones on the endangered list, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other observation here about the legislature is, it's like Groundhog Day. What's going on? Are they frozen? I mean, it seems like everything is pretty much the same as when you left. When I left, it's like, oh my gosh! I know that they did take a couple weeks hiatus, and then come back kind of slowly here. Let's say. Well, I was going to ask Josh that on Mondays we've been talking with Jerry Kornfield of the Everett Herald, who covers Olympia, and he said,
you know, pretty much there hasn't been a lot of public conversation, and Olympia watchers speculate, well, maybe they're in the back rooms trying to hammer out deals. Is that what?
Sure. I mean, one big thing happened this week that highlighted that they are still incredibly far apart, and that is that the Democratic-controlled House passed a fix sort of to reestablish the estate tax.
Right.
This is something that it's very confusing to talk about, but the court sort of nullified it. So there were going to be refunds going out to couples where there was a loophole. Married couples at a $2 million threshold wouldn't have to pay. That's where the estate tax threshold is. Wouldn't have to pay and would get refunds. Meanwhile, the House Democrats passed a bill this week to fix that loophole, close the tax loophole, and bring in about $160 million in new revenue in this biennium. However, on the other side, they sent it over to the Senate, passed this. What the Senate did was the exact opposite. They are taking up a bill today that would essentially raise the threshold so less people would have to pay it from $2 million to $5 million, and actually slash the estate tax by 25%. So, real quick, is you know, the irony being this was approved by the voters in 2006 by 62% statewide. Only two or three legislative districts didn't approve it, going exactly against what the Republicans say. They're for the will of the voters, right? Tim Iman is for the will of the voters. And this is exactly what the Democrats are trying to do.
We're talking Over the Week's News with Josh Feit, who's founder and editor of Publicola at Seattle Met. Joni Balter back with us from her sojourn abroad. She's assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Knut Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com, and a little mea culpa. Last week, I misspoke when I said there were no legitimate women candidates in the race for Seattle mayor. Three women will appear on your August primary ballots. Joey Gray, that is a woman, Kate Martin, and Mary Martin. In addition to those three candidates, six men, Bruce Harrell, incumbent Mike McGinn, Doug McQuaid, Ed Murray, Charlie Stedeker, and Peter Steinbrück. The top two vote-getters do go on to the November general election, and we'll be talking to all the candidates over the course of the summer here on Weekday on KUOW.
56 degrees in Seattle under a cloudy sky. Expecting the sun later this afternoon with a high of 67.
People expect too much from their cars.
The car won't move.
Yeah.
There was no warning whatsoever.
What did you expect, like a postcard?
So on Car Talk, we teach people to help themselves.
Yeah, you need the book.
Yeah, I've got the book.
Well, to throw the book away, it obviously hasn't helped at all.
But Car Talk isn't just a series of questions and answers.
Oh, no.
We really debate the issues.
So I'm better off selling the car?
No. Join us for Car Talk.
Even if you don't drive or own a car, you'll probably find yourself laughing along with Car Talk tomorrow morning at 9 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Annie Wright Day School, committed to providing a place where boys and girls in preschool through grade 8 can inquire, explore, and thrive. Annie Wright's June 4th preview provides a glimpse of the school's community and curriculum. More information at aw.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:20.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday, and every Friday in the 10 o'clock hour, we talk over the week's news with a panel of journalists. With us, Knut Berger, Joni Balter, and Josh Feit. We were talking about state politics and local politics. A whole lot revolves around money. This week, we saw a 24-hour fast food worker strike in Seattle. It was a solidarity with fast food workers from around the country. And it's an interesting contrast because we're talking about Olympia. We're talking about, you know, this fight over the budget that we don't know what's happening with. And at the same time, we're seeing about the housing price in Seattle. The average is up to where it was in 2005. We had a report about unemployment. The official King County rate is 4.4%, which is officially full employment in somebody's eyes. So we see indications of health on the one side, and then low wages. And I wonder, is it an indication then that the jobs that we're seeing are going to be $9.50 an hour? I think that was the average of the fast food salary. I mean, is that it? We're just going to have crummy jobs?
Well, the debate is about the fast food strike. But when I landed, I thought it was about the food, just to tell you.
And well, then, there could be that.
Then it was like, oh, it's not what's in the food. It's about the salaries, which, you know, very serious issue how these folks feel. Interestingly, and I'll just bring this from the Slovenian perspective, I was with these young folks in Slovenia, and they're teachers, and they work for the Slovenian State Department, and they were talking about how what they make is 3 or 4 euros an hour. They could make more if they went to a fast food place.
Wow.
In their country. But that doesn't take away from what's going on here in any way. I just want to put it in some perspective.
Is Slovenia one of the countries in Europe that has that huge young
It has a big one. It's not as big as, say, like Spain or something like that, but it does have, there was this hopelessness that I was struck by. These were well-educated people, but they did not expect to get jobs that were more than 3 or 4 euros, which would maybe be like $5, $6 an hour, something like that. But here, obviously, the fight is about a fair wage at a time when housing prices in Seattle are going up. You've got very low unemployment. And so it was a very interesting day for these folks to rally. The mayoral candidates were sort of falling all over themselves to say the right thing, to be connected to it and say the right thing. Because sometimes mayoral candidates set up their events in the wrong way.
Well, that's a whole other topic that we can touch on. this question of money, given that there are signs that we're emerging from this recession, but at the same time, the state still has this huge budget problem. I don't see, you're watching it more closely than I am, Josh, but I don't see where all these pieces fit together. The stock market's soaring, wages are low, we have no money. What?
What I make of yesterday's I think they were calling it poverty strike or strike against poverty. And in the wake of exactly what you're talking about, that we're seeing these kind of signifiers typically of the economy getting better, the stock market doing better, unemployment going down, housing prices going up, et cetera, finally. But at the same time, you're seeing real wages not growing. And so I think what's happened here, and this is – my thought about it is – very much a union effort. And I think what it did was it's the unions. So 2 years ago, you remember, a little over a year and a half ago with the Occupy movement, sort of was raising kind of the same issues.
Right.
But in some ways, and people might be, liberals who listen to this show might be frustrated to hear it, it kind of sputtered out in a way. It was not as effective as the Tea Party was in electing candidates and shaping the dialogue, although we do have the news this week that Michelle Bachmann is out and maybe that's the end of the Tea Party. But anyway, and I think what you're seeing now is that was this kind of an organizational failure in some ways. They did, but their legacy is they did help frame the debate exactly about what you're talking about. These rich people doing well, the 1%, et cetera, and the rest of us not. And now you're seeing the unions, I think, have been, for the last year and a half, my sense is they've been assessing what was happening. And a structure like the unions that have the organizing power have stepped in, taking the Occupy rhetoric, and I think you're going to see more of this, of the unions kind of take control of this movement. So I think that's what this was a real sign that the unions are going to step up these kind of direct actions and voice the things that were articulated by the Occupy movement.
It's interesting. I have to turn to you, Knut, for the long view, and this wasn't on your list of articles, but it makes me think about Boeing and whatever is happening with Boeing and its unions, which is like we're going to outsource our work to other states I don't think they'd say overtly to weaken the unions, but it's to de-unionize.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was thinking about that, too, as we're talking, because that was a major story that Dominic Gates at the Times had quoting the CEO of Boeing saying, well, I'm talking like Darth Vader here, but we're going to, eliminate these jobs and we're going to squeeze our suppliers, except they call it some kind of happy partnership plan with the suppliers. I'm sure they're really.
But they're going to be on a no-fly list. That's a quote.
Yeah, exactly. So And I think, I mean, one of the puzzling things about the recovery, I mean, it isn't so puzzling. The stock market's doing well precisely because the companies have gained efficiencies by laying off so many people and not hiring back. So you're in this situation where you look and you say, great, my 401k is doing well. Yeah, but my daughter's working for $8 an hour or so, whatever. You know, and there are these kind of trade-offs. Unions have a tough job because the competition for manufacturing jobs and other things are often from low-wage non-union or low union member, and unions have been losing membership, and they have to prove their effectiveness to a new generation of young people. I don't wish that fast food workers were getting paid so little, but I wish they were the only ones who were. I mean, yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, yeah. There are plenty of people in all kinds of jobs, trucking jobs and other kinds of jobs, that are getting paid wages that people just wouldn't believe. I mean, they're basically minimum wage with either no benefits or benefits that are so expensive to get that they eat up all your salary. It's not a sustainable situation. And so, you know, I think unions have to prove their effectiveness, but it's a difficult climate in which to do that when it's easy to export certain kinds of jobs.
Well, one of the hallmarks of the recession was that companies learned to live and work with fewer employees. And so employees are reluctant to raise too much fuss about any of it because they're happy to have a job. That became the mantra.
Right. It's better to have half a pie than no pie.
Right. That became the mantra of the recession. But now that the recession is truly ending, this is really the question. So what will the companies do? Will they hire back up? Will employees have real rights? That's what this debate is about.
Yeah, I mean, you gain benefits from efficiency, supposedly, with increases in productivity and profitability and that kind of thing. But it goes back to the roads issue. What are you building for the long term? Are you building an economic structure that's going to decimate the middle class for short term gains? How are you going to be building in people into, a positive future, who aren't software coders and that kind of thing. Can I make one more?
Sure.
And this touches on, I mean, we've already touched on it, but the economic news about home prices, this is another real double-edged sword. And
yes.
I've been listening to some of the coverage on NPR this week, which has been doing quite a bit. And you hear people cheerleading the rise in housing prices. Do we really want, on NPR, one of the reporters was saying, well, housing prices still aren't back where they were in 2008. It was a bubble. We don't want them to go back to where they were because that was an artificially inflated fraud. And so you want prices to go up a little bit, but you don't want to price people out. And we just have so many of these kind of fundamental things that we have to get straight.
We're talking over the news with Knute Berger, Joni Balter, and Josh Veit. And Josh, this brings me back to Olympia and the budget, because Knute's talking about housing prices. But in all this sort of, balanced budget efforts to have some kind of balance, what is getting cut at the state level and the federal level are social safety programs.
In the Senate budget.
Yeah. But are they going to come at some point to an agreement that some things need to be maintained or not?
I mean, the question on the table right now is there going to be revenue, right?
Right.
And the Republicans have gotten it to a point where kind of the only thing government really is supposed to do, and this is because of the McCleary decision, is fund education, right? So if we prioritize education, then everything else is kind of the social programs take the cuts. The Democrats are saying, hey, we need to do both. This is the job of government. And so the question is there going to be revenue? And the Republicans, the majority coalition caucus, have stuck together and they are not budging on this issue.
So what will happen is the deadline for adopting a budget will drive what happens. You know, this is the first time in quite a number of years that the Republicans have had some power in Olympia. And, the majority coalition caucus is supposed to be a moderate body. But that's sort of not how it's played out. there's not a lot of sort of moderating and meeting in the middle so far. Now, sometimes when they're quiet down there,
they're moderating.
Everybody likes that because that means they're not talking about it. They're actually doing it. So that could be as well. But what's going to happen is this is going to be forced. You have to have a budget by July 1. And so it just who's going to blink first. It's very reminiscent, actually, of Washington, D.C., where you just sort of coalesce around your side. And you say, we're not moving. But then the deadline comes.
Well, an interesting thing, I think, that threw the Republicans for a little bit of a loop is that they have been used to more Governor Gregoire, who played more of a mediating role. And Jay Inslee, you know, has made it clear he's on the Democrat side, the Democratic side, and it says, look, I'm not a referee, I'm on the field. And I think the Republicans were trying initially to say, hey, we're with Jay Inslee, you know, after he's elected and kind of trying to wave, and he's not for new taxes, we're not for new taxes, and we're a little surprised when they saw him basically issuing the same kind of proposal that the House Democrats. And so that, I think, made negotiations stumble a little bit.
You mentioned the Senate Majority Caucus, or what is the official?
Majority Coalition.
Coalition. Senator Mike Carroll, we should just mention, Lakewood Republican, died this week. He was being treated for a pre-leukemic condition. It's very sad and unfortunate. Yes. Death at 69. But I heard Austin Jenkins, our political reporter in Olympia, say, well, for the Republicans, it's actually sort of a good thing because he wasn't there and now they can replace him and have a vote. And he wasn't a vote that was there. Is that right?
Jim Hargrove was voting for him out of a courtesy. He's a Democrat, but he was voting out of a courtesy for him. And certainly when someone is sick in Olympia, that's sick. You know, people don't pounce like, you know, let's act like he's not here or something. There was a tweet earlier that there will be some names forwarded to replace him. Down there in Pierce County.
Mm-hmm. They have been already. I think they have 60 days or something.
Yeah, but they're going to try to go quickly so they can have sort of an active participant in there. But it doesn't really, you know, anybody could go and try to pounce on this and say, oh, okay, they don't really have the majority coalition. But I don't think anybody's going to do that. I think that they will proceed as if, you know, his position would be filled somebody who is like-minded to him. So I don't think you'll see anything quite like that. But it doesn't help this legislature, which just seems so stalemated.
More than normal?
Yes, it's late May.
I mean, they're always stalemated.
Yes, it's late May. It's almost summertime, folks.
I'm trying not to call it the special session anymore, the overtime session. We have to come up with some new euphemisms.
Special for who, you know?
Yeah, some new euphemisms. But this isn't the first time. I mean, there are years that I recall that there have been two of these sessions.
Oh, certainly, yes. But it is dragging on. At some length.
I mean, it looks like it's going to go into another special session at this point, given how far apart they are. You know, part of the issue, what makes this year different, is that the Republicans formally took control. So, you know, the Democrats saw this or should have seen this coming. Last year, there was a coup. I'm using air quotes for those listening on radio. A coup. On the budget itself,
right?
The very same kind of coalition with a few name changes. The Republicans recognized, hey, over the summer, if we could do that, well, let's do it all session. And so the difference being now they've chaired up, so they're sort of running the floor. They can prevent bills, they can control the conversation. So it is much different, which has allowed them to lock down the way they have on the budget.
Is there still as much anti-Seattle King County? Vitriol.
Yeah, that never goes away, and that's just come up all session. And anytime you throw the word Seattle in there, it's an evil Seattle project, and that's always going to happen in Olympia, and no matter who's mayor.
The interesting thing is, with the unfortunate death of Mike Carroll, there is an opportunity for the Democrats to attempt to take control of the Senate in that short time period they might have. The Republicans have, Kirby Wilbur was quoted in the Washington Wire today. He's trying to bully the Democrats out of even thinking of this because it throws the Senate into a tie. Brad Owen, as Lieutenant Governor, would have the tie-breaking vote. He's a Democrat. And so they don't even want discussion of the possibility that if the Democrats were very aggressive, they could, with Brad Owen in charge, conceivably ram some stuff through.
There's a flaw in that theory, though, which and it reveals a real problem with the Democrats, which is that two other members who didn't initially join the coup, but this is Senator Steve Hobbs and Brian Hatfield, they are conservative Democrats, and they actually at the very top of the session became chairs. They joined Rodney Thom's program. They also voted for one of the main bills that the Republicans are having as a take-home bill, which is the workers' comp reform, which is a bad omen if the Democrats try and go there. They're going to find Hargrove's not so much. It's not sort of an issue of Hargrove. It might be an issue of Steve Hobbs and Brian Hatfield, who are kind of the troublemakers for their current caucus as opposed to the ones who already split.
Brad Owen can also be a little bit conservative in his voting from time to time.
Yeah. Another problem with that theory is that there's apparently a legal question about what Brad Owen can and cannot vote on.
And he gets to decide some of those legal questions.
Although
yeah, that's
and
the
a
way
legal
it's structured.
A threat to that, but I,
yeah. His conservative streak, though, has been on this two-thirds issue, which that's most notably what his streak has been in. And the Supreme Court made it clear that that's no longer an issue. So I think the Democrats could count on Brad Owen.
You're talking about two-thirds for passing a tax.
That's right.
But
okay.
See, here's the tricky part. It depends on when they replace Mike Carroll.
Absolutely.
And what days are available to actually do something, and who would try to maneuver to hold that up. So
the state legislature, fascinating. Just one quick question I have. Why is it that the city of Seattle has more revenue now, but nothing's moved on a state level in terms of revenues?
Well, the city's booming right now. A couple of things. First of all, the city has Amazon, which is just, you can watch the job growth in the state from...
Are they exempted from B&O taxes for the state? Amazon and all the booming companies here? I mean, aren't they getting taxed?
Well, what I'm talking about mostly, right. I don't know the answer to that, but what they are doing is they are here, they are building, employees are spending, paying for all kinds of amenities throughout the city. The other thing is, and this has not been discussed that much, is that the voters approved that library levy last year. And that is manna from heaven for the city budget. So it's real dollars that are in the budget. So they went from a couple of those years to be never in the dire straits that that Olympia was in, or even the county, to they're more flush than they've been. They are.
Go ahead. I'm just going to say that the city of Seattle derives a vast proportion of its revenue from fees related to development. So it's either from development fees or taxes, sales taxes and whatnot related to those. So we're going through a boom in construction. Yeah. That's a big part of it.
Yeah.
I was just going to say an oddity for the Republican position is that if they were not so pathologically against taxes, given that they are sort of net receivers of state money and King County and Seattle are net contributors, they would gain if they would pass some taxes and they could capitalize off of the Seattle boom.
We're talking over the week's news. Josh Feit, who's founder and editor of Publicola at Seattle Met. Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Knut Berger, Mossback at crosscut.com. I'm Marcy Simon. We'll be back.
The review of the news continues in 1 minute here on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. 55 degrees in Seattle, the sky gradually clearing. It's supposed to wind up partly to mostly sunny this afternoon with a high of 67.
Odd couples don't come much odder than President Obama and Governor Christie playing a carnival game on the Jersey Shore boardwalk this week. Governor Christie actually threw a football through a tire to impress the president. Man, you thought they were close before. I'm Peter Sagal. If this weekend's news quiz lasts more than 4 hours, consult your doctor.
That's tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock on KUOW.
Regional coverage of the environment through EarthFix, a Northwest Public Media partnership, is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Real Networks Foundation.
It's 10:40. Updates on the investigation into the ricin-laced letters recently mailed to lawmakers in our top-of-the-hour newscast, which is 20 minutes away.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. It's Friday. We're talking over the week's news with Joni Balter, Knut Berger, and Josh Feit, and we've been talking about Olympia. Let's talk about Seattle, where we sit for a moment, although there's some interesting news I read this morning about Bellevue and its ethics policy at the city of Bellevue. But yesterday, Cafe Racer was closed. It was the first anniversary of the horrific shooting there. And to acknowledge that the cafe, which is about a mile, less than a mile from here, closed down. The mayor's office had considered announcing the date of the second gun buyback at Cafe Racer yesterday. And after talking to the folks there, that was canceled, seen as a crass political move.
Well, they've been having a few issues with staging these. You know, the mayor's race is in full flower here, and so everyone is trying to gather as much excitement around their candidates. So the mayor's had a couple problems with the gun buyback announcements. So earlier, there was an announcement about a gun buyback program related to the gun buyback, where you would weapons to words, so that you would have school children involved in creating plaques that have a better message, you know. But what had happened is that they'd already melted those down into something like rebar, mm-hmm. and the mayor knew of that, but pressed on with his press conference at that time. And so, if you're going to do a sort of gimme press conference like that, the one thing you don't want to do is kind of stumble on that, which is what occurred there. And in this case, the word got out as well. The mayor definitely wants another gun buyback program. It's mm-hmm. popular. People like the idea of it. You can get upstaged by the other, you know, the gun promoters. But be that as it may, it's a mayoral event. And so he was going to announce that at Cafe Racer and then thought better of it. So with these kinds of press conferences, the details aren't supposed to get out like this, and you're not supposed to stumble, because these are sort of gimmies.
Well, Josh, it was Publicola where you reported that it was Cairo who broke both of these.
Yeah, I was going to say kudos to Cairo. Yeah. They did a great job on both these stories that Joni is talking about, and the mayor has really stumbled on it. And like Joni is saying, sort of stumbled on a kind of a gimme issue. I would say that gun buybacks, the problem I actually have is that the gun buyback just seems like such a kind of symbolic move and doesn't really directly deal with the issue of gun violence. I mean, I feel like it's asking people to trade in one car, give them cash, and they'll go get another car, and that's your solution to global warming. Like, it's an odd one. But again, Joni's right, they're popular. And these two gaffes by McGinn, have been embarrassing. They've been super awkward.
Well, we've talked about this on the show before, but we're in the era of a press conference a day almost from the Seattle mayor's office. It was a couple weeks ago, I think, we talked about it. But there's still, I mean, I get an announcement at least one a day of some program that's going to be happening.
Well, they're sort of like yard signs in a way. What I mean by that is that they reveal energy in a campaign. You know, not every news organization goes to every one of these announcements. They don't have time for that, and they don't. But if you don't have them, oh, it's kind of like you're almost sleeping. Same with yard signs. Yard signs don't win races, but if there's no yard signs, it's where are they?
Matt Fixey did a story on Crosscut that actually charted the mayoral press releases and the campaign re-election campaigns. So it's very common for the bar chart to go way up, and in some ways it would be malpractice not to have
a press conference every day.
Political malpractice. Well, I mean, McGinn, it's interesting because one thing, he was criticized for not doing this kind of stuff, and he sort of learned his lesson maybe a year and a half ago or whatever. He started doing more of it. You know, if any department in the city has something to announce, the mayor's going to be there, you know, like bikes on wheels or whatever the heck it is.
Wheels on bikes.
Wheels
what about
bikes.
That program?
Yeah.
Come on.
And, you know, he's going to get out in front of it and make it a mayoral thing if he thinks, you know. And then of course, in campaign season, it is an advantage of incumbency, but you have to finesse it correctly, you know. And you're not done any favors if obviously, you know, the Cafe Racer thing, you have to it's delicate because there is a political way in which Cafe Racer is relevant, but you have to be extremely careful with the you know, making sure the families and everybody else are on board with something that's also a kind of memorial service, you know, that kind of thing. And so, those kind of goofs happen, but small gaffes, if they fit a narrative about a mayor, And Greg Nichols learned this. If you know, he got punished in the middle of summer for a snowstorm that
had forgotten, right?
Yeah, right. those little things. And so, you know, it's just in a race where the incumbents' approval ratings are as low as they are, you know, he can't afford that.
A couple of things going on with these press releases, and it is, I agree, there's one a day from McGinn, and I wonder if we see them as reporters, and so it's very clear what's going on. I'm not sure, you know, it depends on if TV stations and other media outlets pick them up, and does the public see this as well. There is a superficial aspect and a campaigning aspect to it, too, but two footnotes. One, I will say, I think that there is a shift in the city, and there is more of a sense that McGinn, who had kind of a disastrous first year, 2 years, things are functioning a little better. And I think while this is in some ways a superficial campaign move, it does reflect a little bit more action from the mayor's office. I will say, and one thing he's really picked up on and doing these press releases on is his opposition to the coal trains, which he plays up because he's kind of building coalitions, and he's accused of being very divisive. Now, he hypes on his website, his CAM website, that he's kind of a success as being against the coal trains. Now, I don't know what the success is. He's making statements. But final thing, I was going to compare it to Ed Murray, who's also obviously running for mayor. He has not used the bully pulpit in the same way that Mike McGinn is now, in that Ed Murray could win big points as being the defiant minority in Olympia fighting against the evil Republicans, and Seattle would love that. And he just has been quiet.
Do you think that he's being careful of crossing some kind of ethics line
while he's not in session? To be campaigning in the middle of the legislature?
I'm not talking about campaigning. What I'm talking about is using the position of fighting the Republicans, standing up, making speeches.
To use
that position as the minority leader of the Democrats against this hated Republican majority. He's been kind of quiet on that front in terms of being the loyal opposition. So that's what I'm talking about.
I get that. That makes perfect sense. The mayor's office, I was picking up on one thing you said, Josh, earlier. You know, when McGinn first came into office, he didn't like that sort of regional we leaders, we're all working together.
Right.
Some of the sort of recent press conferences, he has learned the use of the word we instead of I or Seattle Independent. So he is trying to team with, you know, various departments and various other leaders where he is part of the region. That is a change for him.
Although I do think quickly that Ed Murray, in a positive way, is starting to define the campaign as one about regionalism versus kind of a Seattle partisanship that McGinn offers, and I think that's going to be an interesting debate if the race does boil down to McGinn and Murray. And there's no way to know if that's going to be the case, but I think regionalism that Joni's bringing up is going to be a main issue in this mayor's race.
What role is the ongoing efforts to reform the police department? What role is that going to play in this election? We see news that the department acknowledges it broke public records laws when it withheld from the Seattle Times its internal memo about response to the May Day demonstrations last year. I mean, pretty much once a week we see something happening at the police department.
Well, there's no doubt that the police department, and this is true many a year, and it will certainly be true this year, that the workings and the troubles in the police department will be one of the top three or four factors in the race. Probably diminished a little bit by the fact that the chief is on the way out, and that there will be a search probably after the November election that yields someone new. So it's muted a little bit by the fact that change is coming in that way. But, you know, transparency is sort of the big story here. So why wasn't that memo released? Why keep it? Why create any more sense that the public does not have access to information about its very own police department? Another story that broke this week had to do with a lack of public information at Magnuson Park, you know, an area that had been fenced off because it had some radioactive materials in it. This was not announced to the public.
For 3 years.
What were the safety considerations and concerns about that? And why don't we just level with our people? Transparency is always an issue in a mayor's race.
I think the way police accountability plays in the mayor's race as a theme, more than this kind of up and down, do we want more accountability or do we want tougher police and if crime is a problem? The way it plays in a larger way, I think, is that there were two kind of big major news stories in the past year, which is the McCleary decision on education and the Department of Justice showing up in Seattle and saying, get your act together. Those two stories are linked in that they show mom and dad showed up and addressed two long festering issues in this town. And in the police accountability one and the Department of Justice one, you saw the mayor being resistant to that. And I think that was a mistake, because I think the public in linking McCleary and the DOJ welcomed some mom and dad. They welcomed the grown-up stepping in and saying, let's address these issues. And McGinn's resistance, which did seem a little parochial, kind of like the local cop that doesn't like when the FBI comes in that TV show and that tension. I think McGinn played that role, and I think to his detriment, and he got in that squabble with Pete Holmes over, and I think all of it became too messy for the public, but ultimately it just seemed like a bad thing for McGinn.
It's certainly an issue on the campaign trail. When you go to forums, people ask about the issue. They ask about the police department. It's interesting. I mean, in the past, there's often been a law and order candidate. There really isn't a law and order candidate. I mean, Charlie Stadecker kind of tiptoes up to that with a few comments, but there's really not a law and order candidate.
Well, they lost it when Burgess dropped out.
Yeah, I was going to say, wasn't that the law and order candidate?
And the closest you could get to it. The real focus is a police department you can trust. Can we have a police department that we can trust? And, those are the kind of systemic issues. And I think McGinn is not helped for the reasons that Josh outlined. Peter Steinbrück, of course, brings up the Pete Holmes thing every chance he gets, because he talks about what good buddies with Pete Holmes and how he gets along with a city attorney, and that, you know, he uses it that way. Bruce Harrell speaking to issues like police cameras and restraining drones and that kind of thing, and talking about it that way. As far as I know, Ed Murray's not talking about it at all. Have you guys, or much? He seemed
Ed on the stump does talk about it. He doesn't talk in specifics. I mean, he does lead with it. And what I've heard him say, Ed Murray say, is, you know, we want to have a world-class police department. And he kind of says, and he hypes this DOJ thing. He says, it is embarrassing that a progressive city, this is his line, you know, it's embarrassing that a progressive city like Seattle is under DOJ consent decree. And he does bring it up. What I haven't heard are the solutions from Ed Murray.
Right, the suggestions. It is a campaign trail issue. They are asked about it. It's on people's minds, and it's fairly near the top of the list.
Well, you know, since these candidates are all, let's face it, you know, Democrats, liberals, they're not going to disagree that much on actual policy. So what you're hearing quite a bit is style. I get along better with others. I know how to work in a regional context. I wouldn't embarrass our city, our police department, by having the feds come after me. My style is different, better. And if you think about the voters, they buy stuff like that because they don't like a mess. They don't like anything that looks like it's not working. So that's where some of this mayoral contest will be decided.
I find it fascinating because Connie Rice, who I believe was hired by McGinn's office to come and advise on this, Connie Rice, an attorney who's been very involved in the Los Angeles police reform efforts, she came to town, talked to her at length, and she's like, you people are too all over it. You need to step back about five paces and let it happen, because it's going to take a decade. It's not going to happen this year.
But it's been going on for a decade or more. This issue has just ranked Seattle.
Well, the issue has.
But the point is interesting, because we are sort of watching it on the day-to-day, hour-to-hour, minute-to-minute basis.
Right.
And so for somebody who's watched change occur in other departments, it's like, you know, the pieces are in place. Give it a second. Let it bake for a sec. Right.
I mentioned this once before, I still feel bad for Jim Pugel to have to be the person who holds it all together until the mayor is elected in November, because it's a lot of months to try to.
Well, he's not formally out of applying.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I know, he might want to be right there in the soup the whole way.
Would you?
I think it.
Any of you want this job?
I haven't applied.
Maybe Tim Burgess wants the job.
I think probably not. Well, they've put on my list one happy story on tomorrow, which is June 1st. The Patches Pals are coming to Fremont to designate 34th Street between Fremont Avenue and Trollway. J.P. Patches Place. I think this is something that a major landowner in Fremont, Susie Burke, has been pushing for quite some time. But, you know, we name streets after
Edgar Martinez.
The Edgar Martinez Way, Martin Luther King Jr. Way, which I would argue maybe a larger person to honor than J.P. Patches. But
it's also a bigger street while we're at it.
I mean, is that we have August Wilson, you know, alley over by the Seattle Rep. It's not even as big as J.P. Patches Way. I mean, is this the best way to honor folks that mean something culturally to us?
The best way? Well,
is it the only way?
It's a
way?
Good way. I mean, I'm
you're going to be there? Are you going to be there?
No, I'm not going to be there, but I consider myself a Patches pal from way back. So, and I JP still looks over my shoulder, make sure I clean my plate and brush my teeth.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
But I think the idea, I mean, you know, and Fremont has decided to be the Leavenworth of kitsch, you know, and whether it's the troll or Stalin or the
Lenin
statue.
Stalin.
Yeah,
yes.
No, I know that. The Lenin statue or the, you know, whatever it is. And you know, I'm glad there's a statue of JP. I think the point that you raised, which I actually wrote about a few years ago, is that we have these random, you know, kind of streets, like you mentioned, Edgar Martinez Way and Mary Gates Way. I mean, these kind of occasional things that get done. But most of Seattle's dynamic history has occurred in the last 100 years since the streets were named.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's
if you think about the worthy Seattleites, and I'm not talking about people who are alive today, but I mean authors and, you know, artists, politicians, business people. I mean, we have an incredible history of people who are in no way recognized by the street grid, which is mostly either numbers or named after real estate speculators in the 19th century, or things like, you know, flowers
or the founding members.
And I've suggested
city.
Naming our alleys.
Oh, well, there you have it.
Of which we have, you know, miles and miles and miles.
All right. So, listeners, we want you to send in your street name suggestions. You can post them to Weekday at KUOW on our Facebook page. Like to thank Knute Berger, the Moss back at crosscut.com, Joni Balter, assistant political editor for Seattle Times. Welcome back. And Josh Feit, founder and editor of Publicola at Seattle Met. Always a pleasure to have you in as well. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Kyle McLaughlin's our guest Monday on Weekday here on KUOW.
It's been a year now since Washington State privatized liquor sales. So how's that going? We'll find out in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Friends of Youth, providing services in 2012 to more than 5,000 East King County youth, including foster care, emergency shelter, counseling, and housing at 20 locations. Learn more at friendsofyouth.org, helping kids since 1951.
Swing through Saturday night with music of the 1920s through the 1950s and beyond on the Swing Years. I'm Amanda Wild. Join me for adventures in popular music of the 20th century, the Swing Years, 7 p.m. to midnight, Saturday nights on 94.9 KUOW.
Support for KUOW comes from the Everett Clinic, with comprehensive heart and vascular centers in both Everett and Smoky Point, offering screening, diagnosis, and technologically advanced treatment options. More at everettclinic.com/heart.